Stay with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Sulis. Interested in learning new skills online at a pace that suits you? Visit ecollege.ie to apply for one of our free online courses.
Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
The final part of a three-part documentary series telling the story of Cavan businessman Sean Quinn aired on RTE1 last night. Quinn Country followed his rise from a teenager working on his family farm to becoming the wealthiest man in the country before being declared bankrupt in 2011. And last night we heard the final parts of the extensive interviews with Sean Quinn.
When you set the tone for war, when you set the tone to Quinn, and used those heavy hands and put on security people all around the place, up the mountain, 100 people to make sure that everything was okay. In a place that was so peaceful. We had come through from 1973 to 2000, and there was trouble in the north, and there was people being killed and shot right, left and centre. And the Quinn Group worked their way through all of that and never had any trouble. And for them to come in and do what they'd done, I think it was absolutely disgraceful, and I believe that the last day I take a breath.
Joining me in the studio now to talk more about the series is editor of The Currency, Ian Keogh, who you will have seen in the documentary. Ian, you appeared extensively in it. Good morning to you. Thanks
morning,
for coming in. Where to begin? I think the whole country is talking about this, which we saw over the last three nights. But just to sort of contextualise our chat before we start, the scale of Sean Quinn's debt, just remind us of that and the legacy of that for taxpayers, for the state.
Yeah, for everybody. So if you look at what Sean Quinn owed, lost on his gamble in Anglo-Irish Bank, that was $2.3 billion. Now, I know we've become desensitised to billions and millions, but $2.3 billion. And he owed a further $1.3 billion to bondholders, so they were international banks and financiers. So that was the sum of his actual debt, was about $3.6 billion, and through his family. And then on the other side of it, I think, and what we're still living with the legacy of today, was the essential collapse of Quinn Insurance. And for all that Sean Quinn said about the amount of money Quinn Insurance was making throughout the three parts, when administrators appointed by the central bank went in and started looking under the bonnet, they essentially uncovered a €1 billion black hole. Sean Quinn and his insurance company wasn't setting aside the right amount for future claims. So it makes it seem as if you're making loads of money. But in reality, those claims are going to come due at some point. Mm-hmm. And they came due to the sum of about €1 billion. And we're still paying that through the Quinn levy on people's motor insurance policies.
That's 2%, isn't it, for everybody?
And that's looking like that's going to be there for another 5 or 6 years.
Mm-hmm. What we saw, particularly in the first part, was how he built that company from nothing, from scratch. I mean, clearly we're dealing with somebody here who was a very astute businessman, a really hard worker, very successful at what he did. How does that tally with the gamble that he took that got him into the position that he's in?
I think they're actually two sides of the same coin. So if you look at how he built the business, and I think he was probably the best industrialist, a pure industrialist, like they have in Texas or the States, of guys who build things out of the ground and keep on growing and growing and actually shape the locality. I think that was something that was really striking about watching the documentary, and it was beautifully shot. But you got a sense of Quinn had left a physical imprint on his locality. So there was the Quinn trucks up and down the roads, the windmills. You had the quarries, the factories. The giant queue was emblazoned everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And up until the point of getting involved with Anglo, everything had gone really well for Sean Quinn. Everything he touched had turned to gold. He was essentially the border billionaire with the Midas touch. And I think that gave him a sense of invincibility, because when you do everything well and you succeed in everything over the course of your life, you take on vested interests, you corner markets, you expand internationally, you turn a gravel in your backyard into a €1 billion empire. You think you can do everything and everything is going to work out for you. And that was his view with regard to Anglo, that because everything had gone so well for him in his life, this would too. So even when everybody, even Sean Fitzpatrick and David Drum are saying, we have a problem here, he continued to invest in Anglo, continued to buy shares, continued his stake building, because he believed that whatever Sean Quinn, and at this point was referring to himself in the third person, mm-hmm. because he believed that whatever Sean Quinn did would succeed and he couldn't fail. So the success of what he did in those early days contributed massively to his failure, because he was unable to admit that something he did would fail.
Yeah, I mean, I get that. But I also see that in order to build the business that he did, he had to make lots of difficult decisions and difficult calls that would have required a lot of late nights of thinking and working through balance sheets and, you know, making difficult choices. And I just don't see how that tallies with saying, I'm going to chase the loss here, even though it's tanking.
Yeah, I mean, and Quinn himself has admitted, why did I do it? Why did I do it? I mean, there's a sense out there at one point that he wanted to own the bank, right? So, and a lot of people have commented on this. A number of former Quinn board directors have talked about it. And if you think about it, it's actually a logical follow-on. So you go from, you know, building materials to cement. You need an insurance company to insure them all. What's the next thing? It's a bank. So it was actually conceivable he fancied having a cut at Anglo.
OK, let's have a listen to some more clips now from the programme. There was a sense throughout them all that on the one hand, as you were saying, he accepts blame. On the other, he clearly doesn't.
The whole story turned to the Quinn stealing taxpayers' assets. So we just give them an ideal opportunity to kill us. And they did. Everything was put together for 36, 37 years. It was all gone. We took on something we should never have taken on. We took on an institution, we took on a government and all strands of it, and we just were stupid.
Sean Quinn there. I want to play a clip now of Bernie Maguire for two reasons. She's the sister of Sean Quinn. It's very interesting what she has to say, but she's also one of only two women who appeared over three nights of this documentary. Ian, you didn't make this. You were asked to be part of it, but I think it was extraordinary. And it hasn't gone unnoticed that Bernie and Patricia Quinn were the only two women who featured in a speaking role. Now, Bernie Quinn said she felt like, and the Quinn family felt like, Sean was used as a scapegoat.
The rural culture man on the border area was an easy target. It almost seemed as if he was the fall guy. They made it seem as if he was the cause of the recession in Ireland. Even though the banks were broken, the government was broken, there was a whole lot. And they just couldn't fathom that people were so loyal to him down here.
And then we go to Sean Quinn's description of the moments before he got into that white van which brought him to Mountjoy. This is quite extraordinary.
When Elizabeth Dunn said, look, we've given him 9 weeks and he has a week or whatever time he needs to consider what he wants to say or do, I just took up in the court and I said, I'm going this evening. I went to the bar along with a couple of friends of mine, locals here, and I had 2 pints of beer and 2 or 3 double brandies. And headed straight for the white van and into Mountjoy.
What was it like when that door closed behind you?
I was drunk.
What do you think, Ian, that tells us about Sean Quinn and his personality?
I think it shows how tough he is, how tough he is. And I think that's, you know, if you trace his business career, be it taking on CRH, taking on vested interests and not giving in. And we saw the not giving in part in his downfall. I mean, what's also interesting around what was coming out of there was the sense of victimhood of, you know, it was all taken from us, that we were somehow set up. And I think Bernie Quinn put it, the fall guy. The facts don't bear that out. I mean, one of the great conceits within the whole thing is that the government wanted to take him down. They didn't. The central bank offered Sean Quinn numerous opportunities to retain control of his insurance company. All he had to do was to compromise. He refused to do it. And again, that sort of non-compromise nature. The banks and the bondholders gave him numerous opportunities and he wouldn't compromise with those either.
Yeah, you put it very well in the documentary last night when you said, you know, these people coming down from Dublin. And really, that's all it seemed Sean Quinn and his family could see and his supporters at that time too.
Yeah, and it was a real time and place about it, you know. So you're coming, you know, after the financial crisis, austerity is still there, the troika are still there. And people in the country are feeling it a lot worse. Their post offices are shutting down. The banks that have managed to survive the crash are shutting down their rural branches. And people are looking at it and saying, well, this guy did so much for us that it kind of imbued that rural-urban divide. And Quinn played it for all it was worth. The simple farmer son, the border from the country, an unorthodox figure, an outsider. But I think that sort of reservoir of deep support was for Quinn, but I think it was also an anti-austerity feeling at that time mm-hmm. and a sense that rural Ireland had been left behind.
All right, well, let's hear some more now from the series. The attack on Kevin Lunny comes up a number of times in the interviews. Here's one of the exchanges around that.
The whole thing was a mess. I mean, the whole attacks that happened, people were pointing the fingers at me. I had no hand, act or part in any attack. I suppose I played a bit of football and you get a box in the mouth or you give one or get one and you have to get on with life. There's no point in crying about it. You just get on and move on.
And we got an insight into the previous relationship between Sean Quinn and Kevin Lunny. There's some old footage shown of the presentation of an award.
I'd like to make a presentation to somebody that had a major influence on the success of Quinn Director over the past 10 years. Somebody has to have the respect of their colleagues. And that's the important thing in life. Kevin Lunny always had the respect of his colleagues.
But then when he was asked about Kevin Lunny in the documentary, he made his views about him very clear.
Did you have anything to do with the attack on Kevin Lunny?
Absolutely nothing. Absolutely nothing. Why would I bother my head with Kevin Lunny? Just think about why would I bother my head with Kevin Lunny? One thing I think that somebody should ask Kevin Lunny, why was he attacked? What they have done over the last 6-7 years and the level of betrayal is probably unprecedented in the history of this state.
Ian.
You know what, you just listen to the line, why was he attacked? And I think that's a really unfair line for Sean Quinn to make. Because no matter, and I don't think Kevin Lunny's done anything, there's absolutely no evidence against him. And every person I talk to say he's a great business and a really nice family man and loves his locality. But to ask that question, nobody, regardless of what they've done, deserves to get put into the back of a horse box and be tortured. And I think Quinn's lack of empathy for Kevin Lunny is striking and sobering. And I also think his lack of empathy for the victims of other crimes that went on in that region over the past 8-9 years, where bullets have arrived in the post, where cars have been set on fires, where rifles have been found on wind farms, and obviously the dreadful attack on Kevin Lunny. While he's condemned the violence, he has shown no empathy or remorse for the people who it's impacted upon. Mm-hmm. And it's had a devastating human impact.
Yeah, well, he did, you know, condemn it. And he did say it had nothing to do with him. And we heard that clearly in the documentary. I just want to talk about the response to Father Oliver O'Reilly. So people will know, and if you watched last night, you'll have heard again Father O'Reilly's sermon, which was broadcast at the time and again last night. This was from September of 2019. And in the documentary last night, we saw Sean Quinn and his wife Patricia talking about Father O'Reilly and their response to that sermon.
Don't worry about the boys that done it. Get Sean Quinn, yeah. Get the big boy, get whoever's paying the money.
Just, and the priest was the instigator of all that.
Well, he was badly advised. He was badly advised.
Yeah. I'll never forgive him. Never. Never. And he caled in here in this house and he had tea and he had wine and he had everything he wanted. And that's what he did. A backstabber. That's what he is. A pure backstabber.
The final words in the documentary are left to Sean Quinn. We'll see him break down in tears as he talks about his legacy. Let's hear it.
All I can say is that in my 75 years, I never know me. I never know when he took and he didn't belong to me. Never. I think my legacy will be that I built up a great company. I employed a lot of people in a very poor area. I was an honest man. And that the area will be more successful because of Sean Quinn than it would be without him, and that he got rough justice.
I'd say there wasn't a house in the country where the conversation wasn't had, you know, after that was broadcast at the end last night. You know, how do you feel about Sean Quinn?
I think that's the question, because he's a compelling character. You know, like, he managed to maintain 3 hours of really good television, but he is a compelling character because he's multifaceted, he's interesting, and because his legacy is complicated and confusing. You know, he's right. On one hand, he did something that nobody else could have done in an area that really needed it. On the other hand, he sullied his name and his reputation by sanctioning a scheme to essentially hide 500 million euro worth of assets from the taxpayer. And they're contrasting and competing legacies. Mm-hmm. But he's a complex, compelling character and certainly one of the most fascinating business people to have come from Ireland.
Ian, thank you very much for coming in. That's Ian Keogh, and we're going to continue this after the break because Alan Jukes will be here in the studio, former chairman of IBRC and former Fine Gael leader. That's after this.
Email todaycb at rte.ie. Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
And Alan Jukes, the former chairman of IBRC and former Fine Gael leader, is here. You're very welcome. Thank you for coming in.
Morning, Claire.
Alan. To put it mildly, there was a strong reaction to what you said on the programme last night about people from the border area. And I want to talk to you about that. But just to remind people, here's what you said.
Border people have it in their blood. They are living in communities that have, you know, a long history of violence of different kinds, and they'll more easily turn to it than anybody else will. You know, I'm not saying they're different animals from the rest of us, but you know, whether they have Provo links or V special links or whatever, you know, it's something that's nearer to the way they think than it would be to somebody in South Tipperary or anywhere like that. You know.
Do you regret saying that?
It wasn't as elegantly phrased as it might be, but the fact is I'm conscious of the fact that people in border areas have suffered more from violence than people in many other parts of the country.
That's and not what you said. You said they have it in their blood, that they'll turn to violence in a way that people from South Tipperary won't.
I'm not saying everybody does that. I'm saying it happens more frequently in border areas, and that's been the history. Unfortunately, the deplorable history of those areas for quite some time.
Listen.
And I think it's necessary to point out that the atmosphere in which this all happened was an atmosphere where people were very upset, where people saw a danger to their livelihoods, and there was a particular kind of reaction that was seized on by people who then engaged in sabotage and in some kinds of terrible violence.
Okay, but what's happening today... I'm sorry to cut across you now. Because this is really important. People are really upset by those comments last night. I was watching it on Twitter. I have them in front of me here. Did Alan Jukes just demonise a whole community living along the border? Disgraceful statement. And I expect an apology tomorrow. The messages that we're getting in here this morning echoing the same sentiment. Alan Jukes needs to apologise immediately for his prejudice against the border counties.
I am not saying by any means that the people in border counties are violent people. I'm conscious of the fact, as I've said, that they have suffered from violence more than most other parts of the country. The reason for this particular violence is, and this is another part of the programme that I would like to be quoted, the reason for the upset and the opposition was entirely misdirected. It was directed against people who were trying to save companies that otherwise would have gone to the wall.
Yeah, and I think in fairness that is a separate issue. But people who were very deeply offended by that last night would appreciate an apology today. Will you give them one?
There are people deeply offended by the violence that happened and could have been deeply affected in their livelihoods by that violence. And that's what I was reacting to. And I don't think that the case that was there was in any way a justification for the kind of violence and sabotage that actually happened.
Border people have it in their blood. They have it in their blood.
It's part of the history of that whole area of the country, which I hope we have gone past now. And I do not for a moment say that everybody in the border area is inclined to be violent. That certainly wasn't my intention. I don't believe that. I wouldn't believe it for a second.
They will more easily turn to violence than anybody else will.
because there seemed to be a group of people in that area who will capitalise on upset and turned violence. And that was what happened in this case.
But you weren't referring specifically to a small group of people. You were referring to everybody, to communities in the border area.
I was not saying that everybody in the border area
border people
violent.
Have it in their blood.
It's part of the atmosphere that they live in. It's there. It happens. Violence happens more often in that area and has for years than in other parts of the country.
Yeah, I mean, you
end up... I'm not for a moment saying that all border area people are violent people. Not at all. Mm-hmm. Far from it. They suffer from violence more than people do in other parts of the country.
And do you feel that you should apologise today?
I feel that if people have been offended by that, I just ask them to accept my statement that I don't for a moment believe that people in the border areas are violent people. What I'm saying and what I wanted to reflect was that they have suffered more from violence, misdirected violence, than people in any other part of the country.
Yeah, I found myself last night when I was sitting there putting myself into the shoes of people from those communities. And I thought, if somebody sat there on the television and said that people from Laois have violence in their blood, I would be so upset. I can completely understand how people are outraged today as a result of those comments.
Well, I accept what you're saying. But in fact, as far as I can remember and as far as I know, people from Laois would not have been subjected to the same kind of violence that we have seen in border areas, and particularly in the case of the Quinn Group of Companies.
So you are saying that, are you saying in a way that you were trying to protect those people from this violence that erupted in their community?
Yeah, one of the main concerns that we had in IBRC at the time, one of the main concerns was the preservation of the livelihoods of people in that area. We found a company that could carry on from the Quinn Insurance Company. We put in place a group of people and a structure that kept the industrial companies going until other arrangements could be made. And we did that because we were concerned about the livelihoods of people in that area. The protests that were there were based on the idea that somehow Sean Quinn should be put back in charge of the companies. That was an impossibility, and it has proven to be so in the meantime.
All right.
And that was what I was reacting to.
Yeah.
That violence could have destroyed the livelihoods of people, the people who are most concerned.
I think that's a separate issue, and I feel you're refusing to accept that you characterised an entire population as having violence in their blood. I mean, you sat there and you said, with a smile on your face, I'm not saying they're different animals to the rest of us, but whether they have Provo links or B special links or whatever, it is something that is nearer to the way they think than it would be to somebody in South Tipperary.
The violence erupted there very quickly when the protest started. And I can only say again, Claire, as I've already said to you, I do not for a moment believe that people in the border areas are violent people. The fact is that violence has happened there more frequently, and to the great...
But the people who have been convicted of the violence that you speak of, they're not from there, they're from Dublin.
Some people have been held to account there, and in that particular case that you refer to, I don't think we have found where the origin for that action took
place. But people who live in, Cavan or Monaghan,
listen
to this and they say, I don't have Provo blood.
No,
I'm not a B special.
No, there are many other incidents of violence that happened there for which nobody has yet been held to account. And I have no doubt that there are people in that area who have some idea of who was responsible and who, for various reasons, sometimes through fear and sometimes for other reasons, mm-hmm. won't say anything about it.
The Fine Gael member, the Monaghan TD, Billy Fox, was shot dead by the IRA 47 years ago.
Yes.
He didn't have Provo blood.
No.
But you've characterised an entire population here saying, well, you're either one or the other.
It's the violence was, and I, at the time of the Quinn misadventures, was part of the scene there. I'm not saying that, and I repeat it again, I'm not saying that systematically people who live in that area are violent.
That's what
people.
You said.
They're not.
That's what you said.
As
you
I said,
it's sort
it
of the
not,
first thing that they turn to because
well
of where
phrased.
They're from.
It was not well
okay,
phrased.
Okay, well, we're getting somewhere now. You're
yes.
accepting that it wasn't well phrased.
I've already said that.
But you're not accepting that you shouldn't have said it.
I shouldn't have said it in the way that I said it. What I meant to convey was that the protests that were there and the emotion that was there were seized upon by people who are violent and who carried out acts of sabotage and despicable personal violence against people. And I deplore that.
Okay.
And I think that was seriously damaging and could have been even more seriously damaging to the interests of the people who depended on that group of companies for their livelihoods.
Okay, just some more messages on this. I live close to the border here in Cavan, and along with lots of other people who are offended by his outburst, the least he should do is apologise for his statement. Alan Jukes, another one, obviously hasn't got a clue about people living up on the border. It was disgraceful what he said. He needs to apologise. May says the phrasing by Mr. Jukes is completely out of order. My dad is from Cavan and couldn't be more anti-violent and gentle.
Yes, as that lady said, the phrasing was completely, it was ill-chosen. And I've said that from the beginning.
All right. Alan Jukes, thank you very much for coming
thank
in.
You,
that's
sir.
Alan Jukes, former chairman of IBRC and former Fine Gael leader. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.